Hey, I'm John Bollinger with Premier Guitar at the City Winery in Nashville, and I'm with Don Felder. Don, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Man, so nice to be here.
I was reading about how you grew up. Your first band was with Stephen Stills, right?
Yeah, I had a little band called the Continentals, and Stephen actually showed up in Gainesville and just wound up being in my band. We were together. It was kind of a garage band. Our parents would drive us to the gig. My mom would drive us to gigs, and we got into all sorts of trouble together at fraternity parties that we were way too young to be doing. But yeah, and then he decided he was going to move to California. And the next time I heard from him was on the radio. I heard For What It's Worth, and I went, that sounds like Stephen. And it turned out it was. Right?
Well, and then Tom Petty was in that same group running around.
Yeah, that's great. That's right. I worked in this music store called Lipa Music, and I didn't get paid cash. I got paid store credit. So if I want a guitar or a string or an amp or cables or whatever it was, I'd have to work for it. They'd give me store credit, and then I could get what I wanted. And usually shortly after Christmas, all the young kids that got guitars for Christmas would come in and be complaining about their fingers, you know, trying to learn, and I would be their teacher. And so one of the guys that came in, Tom, came in. I guess he was about 14 or something. He was playing in this little band called the Rucker Brothers Band, which was two brothers, Rodney and Ricky Rucker. Say that fast three times in a row. And both of those guys were just thrashing guitar players. They had no idea of how to one play rhythm and one play lead. And Tommy was playing bass. He wanted to learn how to play guitar so he could front the band. So I started giving him guitar lessons. I think I worked with him with the piano a little bit. And then I went over to his house a couple of times and saw this garage band and went out to a few shows and just trying to help them. Look, one guy play rhythm, one guy play lead, and don't play when the singer's singing, you know, that sort of stuff.
That's great.
It just kind of helped him out a little bit. And Tommy and I used to play on the campus of the University of Florida a lot. Our band's Mudcrutch later was his band.
Right.
And I had a band called Flow, and we'd do these free gigs in the park on Sunday at the University of Florida. But there were a lot of people that kind of grew up in that area.
The Allman Brothers, and you hung with Dwayne back in the day.
Well, we were in Battles of the Bands. You know, what used to be called the Spotlights, and then they were the Allman Joys, and then eventually they became the Allman Brothers. But they always won all the battles of the band. Dwayne was by far the greatest guitar player that I'd ever seen. He was also the first guy I ever saw play electric slide guitar. I'd seen a lot of blues guys play acoustic slide guitar, as you can imagine, but he was the first guy that I saw play electric slide guitar, and he was just on fire.
Wow.
So we used to do these shows together during the summer when the University of Florida fraternities were on holiday. We'd all go to Daytona Beach and play over there in the joints, the dance clubs. And we'd always finish our gigs, and the four of us, Bernie and myself and Dwayne and Greg, would go have breakfast at some diner, all-night diner. And I was sitting there, I said, how do you do that? You know, every time I try to do it, the frets rattle. He says, oh, you got to raise the action. And I said, well, what's your tuning? And so we went over to his mother's house. I remember sitting on the floor in his mother's house. I guess I was 16, maybe 17. Greg was, you know, 18 or something. They were a little older than I was. And Dwayne sat there and showed me the basics of how to play slide guitar.
Wow.
And so I guess I owe my original inspiration to Dwayne by watching him play, and then what foundation I started with came from him showing me how to use it and how to play it and how to tune it. And
but
I never tried to copy him. You know, that was just like trying to copy Hendrix or something. You're not going to ever sound like him, but just used the information he gave me and developed my own style. Yeah. Although I play slide both in regular open tuning and I play it in E tuning as well.
Right.
So you have to be able to use that instrument and play it in a lot of different tunings. So that's the Dwayne story.
That's amazing. And Joe Walsh, your bandmate, actually was learned from Dwayne too, didn't he, to a certain
extent? Yeah. I understand Joe spent some time in and around Dwayne, but when we were together, we were just kids. You know, we were like 16, 17, 18, and he was already on fire. Like I said, he won every battle of the bands, whether it was Petty's band or my band or the Allman Joys or the Spotlights, whoever they were calling themselves. They were just the best musicians around. You know?
Gainesville, it's amazing how much talent came out of that little town.
Yeah, it is. I did this interview with Smokey Robinson, and the same sort of thing happened where they came from, you know, with the whole Motown thing. And Muscle Shoals was another little hotbed of record production. And for some reason, Gainesville was, and I don't know if it was something that was in the water that we were all drinking or something that was in the Gainesville green that we were all smoking led us to prosperity in the music business. I think the latter, most likely.
Fabulous. And did the did Duane Kennan inspire you on the Les Paul thing? Because you've always been a very, to me, the iconic thing is you with the Les Paul or with your double neck.
Well, I didn't really own a Les Paul until early 70s, to tell you the truth. I always had Fenders or Sears guitars or Silvertone or something, you know, that I could afford. And the actually first guitar that I bought while I was working at Lipham's was a Fender Stratocaster. I love those guitars. The way they looked and everything was just great. And so I started with a Fender, and then I this black Les Paul came in that the store bought. And they had to send it back to Gibson to refinish it. It was like a black beauty, you know, with the gold pickups and hardware.
Sure, yeah.
And I said, I want to buy that. I'm going to buy that. When it comes back in, I'm buying it. I'm buying it. So while I was gone on vacation for about 2 weeks, it came back in like 6 months later, and somebody came in and bought it right out from under me. And I came back and heard it was gone. So I'd always wanted a Les Paul, and I missed that first opportunity. And later I wound up having more than I probably deserve, old classic ones. I met this guy in Texas named Tony Dukes when we were going through Texas with the Eagles. He would always show up with a station wagon or a van. The whole back of it would be full of Strats and Telecasters and Les Pauls. And so I would buy just about everything he had in his truck. And what seemed like expensive at the time, by today's standards, was just a steal. The most expensive guitar I bought from him was my original 59 Les Paul Sunburst, and I paid $1,200 for it.
Wow.
And everybody went, "You're crazy to pay that much. That guitar's not worth that." And I went, "Well, okay, you know." And then I bought a ton of Strats and old Tellies, and I just Gretches, everything I could buy, I just wound up buying from Tony Dukes.
So the 59 is at home, but you're touring with
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's hear about this guitar. What is the story?
Well, the story with this is, you know, I use a lot of custom shop replicas of my 59. They put out 300 of my Don Felder models, and I use those. I think I have 10 or 12 of those, and I've set aside five of them, so each one of my kids will get one after my passing. And then they made 150 of the 1275 double necks that they borrowed the original that's hanging in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They took it to their custom shop and matched the colors, the stains, the scratches. There's a split in the top of it, just all sorts of stuff, the way I had it wired. And they put out 150 of those, so I got some of those to leave for my kids as well. So,
that's great.
It was such an honor that Gibson asked me to do that. And so I guess I am more known for Gibson guitars than Fender guitars.
Yeah, well, Don, you're a big deal. So, that's why they did it. You're a honest to God Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. And think about that. How many people from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame came out of Gainesville? It's amazing.
Well, you know, it's just a phenomenon. Like I said, I don't know why. We were really in heavy competition with each other, not only to get jobs, you know, to be hired, but also to just outplay each other. Everybody wanted to be the fastest gunslinger in Gainesville, you know, and play the best. And so we were always kind of pushing each other, like Walsh and I did. Yeah. We just like push each other to raise above whatever you can just sit there and play.
Right. Yeah, that I think that's probably it. Just seeing just that competition.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
Beautiful. So is this actually a replica of your 59?
No, this isn't. I have, I think I have five different rigs. No, I take it back, seven different rigs. I have a complete set in Atlanta, another set in New York, a set in Chicago, a set in LA, and a set in Dallas. And then I have three FedEx sets that go out that I can FedEx just the basic necessities. And then we use backline stuff for other things. And this is one of those. This is like not the Don Felder issue, but it's a nice 59 reissue. I think Gibson just is making better guitars now than they ever have been. Usually what I do is when I get these, the first thing I do is change the pickups.
So what do you have in those?
Well, I'm good friends with Seymour. As a matter of fact, I've known Seymour Duncan and his wife. His wife used to live with me. Don't get that wrong. Not with me personally. But we shared a house together, right? So she was actually living with Tommy Ledden, Bernie Ledden's little brother. And we wound up sharing a house, me and my wife and Tommy. And Kathy, who became Kathy Seymour later. And so I've known her since like 73 or something. Wow. And so Seymour is so great. I go up to his custom shop, and we go into his custom shop and we wind pickups ourselves. We wind Strat pickups, and he's got a file in there. MJ, who's his main custom gal, has this file that has everybody's specifications in it, from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Hendrix and Clapton and just everybody. And you go, well, I want to make a pickup that's somewhere between this spec and that spec. I want to go right in the middle of it. It's the gauge wire and the number of wraps and the size and strengths of the magnet. So we'll sit there and just tell stories and wrap pickups. So I wound up finding this combination that I used from Seymour, and I put them in all my Les Pauls.
Oh, right.
They look the same. But underneath the hardware, it's sort of like a sleeper hot rod, you know, where it looks like a stock car, but underneath it, it's got a different kind of custom wrap pickup.
How cool. So does that feel a lot like your, does it sound a lot like your 59?
It's very much like the old 59, And I was really particular when Gibson reissued those, that we went exactly the same kind of color and scratches and blemishes and checking and the finish and the wrapping on the pickups. The first couple of artist proofs they sent me, they didn't sound quite right. And I tried to make comments to them in phone calls about what they needed to do. And they finally said, you need to get the information from Seymour to wrap those pickups. And so they made it exactly like that. So
great. Good. Okay, so this is awesome. Let's look at what else you're touring with.
Yeah, we can look at my double neck if you want.
Oh, yeah, that's the iconic one.
There you go. There you go, fantastic. Now this, if you notice this, I kind of stripped the humbuckers covers off of these pickups, off the original model. Mm-hmm. And it's wired differently because when we recorded Hotel California, I think I played 16 different guitar tracks on that record.
Wow.
I played like reggae parts, and the acoustic 12-string part, power chord parts, and the descending harmony lines, and the solos, and just a bunch of different guitar parts. And then we got on a sound stage to try to figure out, how am I going to play all those parts? Am I going to put an acoustic guitar on a stand and walk up and lean over it and play the introduction and then step back and pull a Les Paul up and then put it down? And I said, no, as soon as that guitar gets knocked off the stand, that's going to be a calamity, right? So I saw Chet Atkins when I was 14 years old in Daytona Beach. And it was the first time I'd seen a stereo guitar. He had a Gretsch guitar that was wired to stereo, so the bottom three strings went out of one jack over to one amp on the side of the stage, the top three strings went out of another jack to another amp on the top. If you listen to the way Chet plays, he always plays this bass part that goes boom, ding, doom, di, di, doom, ding, doom, do with his thumb. Then he plays the melody on the top, right? So I was sitting in the audience, and he said, told the story about the Civil War and all the people that had died during the war. It's the worst war that America's ever been in because Americans were killing Americans. You know?
Right.
So we need to do something to heal this. And the way I've come to be able to help heal this is like this. And he plays Yankee Doodle Dandy on the bottom strings. Dun, 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 dun. And he says, and you know, everybody knows the theme from the South, which is Dixie. Da, 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 da. So the next time it comes around, he starts playing both of them at the same time. One melody is coming out of one amp, and the other melody is coming out of the other amp. And not only was it really my first stereo experience, but I was just mystified that anybody could play two things at the same time, right? So it took me about a year to figure that out, of trying, what key did he do that in? How did he do that? Not the wiring or anything, but I finally figured it out on acoustic guitar, so I could play Yankee Doodle Dandy and Dixie at the same time. And it was like one night it just came to me. I woke up the next morning and, okay, I can do it. This is how he did. But when I got on the soundstage, when we were putting together Hotel California for the tour, I thought about Chet Atkins having two outputs, and with the flip of the switch, I can go from this neck, which is the 12-string part, mm-hmm. out of one output jack, and it goes into this Leslie effect. Sounds pretty much like the record.
Yeah.
And then when I flip this down, it goes to this neck and goes out of a different output into a regular lead amp. So you have literally two guitars just kind of glued together.
That's
here.
Great.
Instead of having one on a stand and one, you know, that you got to play. It was the only way I could figure out how to do that. And unfortunately, I've been lugging this thing around now for about 40 years. It gets really heavy. You know?
Oh, yeah. That would
but Gibson did
traction.
A remarkable job of reissuing those for me. So I was very delighted to do it. But that's the story of the double neck.
That's awesome. Okay. Well, it's going to be hard to beat that. But let's look at another one. What else do
okay,
you
Okay. Yeah. How about my gold Strat?
So while we're waiting on that, Hotel California, I had read, didn't you record all those on your own before you brought it to the Eagles? You recorded the whole track and brought it
I recorded, I'd probably say, 95% of it.
Wow.
In my back bedroom on a Tiat 4-track.
Wow. And just bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, it was like you'd fill up 3 tracks, bounce it down to 1. Fill up 2 more, bounce it over to the other one. You just kind of kept overdubbing, and it kind of gets degenerated, but you can hear a lot of the parts, you know, including the solo on the end, my first part of the solo, and some of the stuff that Walsh played in the second half of it, you know, and the descending harmony lines that I played on the record, just a bunch of it's all
wow,
in that original
that's
demo.
That's amazing.
Here's our Goldie. Now, I wanted to, I build stuff out of spare parts. That's what this is.
Oh, really?
And like, so I find bodies and pick guards and necks and go up and see Seymour and re-wrap some pickups and change the electronics that are under this Clapton pick guard here. But it's just a kind of a hodgepodge thrown together in a workshop.
Is that like a Dick Dale body or?
I have no idea. I just found it online. I bought the body and Fender sent me a bunch of the necks because I like the way this neck feels.
Yeah.
And Seymour put these pickups together underneath here, although we kept the covers on them so they look stock.
Sure.
And we changed the electronics underneath the bottom of it, slightly on the electronics for the Clapton, and it just looks really great.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
And it plays really great.
And how cool that you made it.
Then Norik sets it up. He goes through everything and figures out that, you know, the neck needs to be a slightly different angle, the arch and the intonation and everything. He's just brilliant. Probably the best luthier. He's almost as good as Luthier. No, he's probably the best luthier I've ever worked with and had the pleasure of dealing with. So anyway, that's my Goldie. It's just
beautiful.
A hodgepodge of parts, and I have a bunch of necks and bodies and stuff, and I'm going to build one that's got a Sustainiac in it because we've been doing a bunch of shows with JY, and he was telling me, you got to use the Sustainiac with the little switches that turn it on and off, and so I'm probably going to build one of those and clone together a bunch of odd parts and build something with that.
Very cool. So can you show me your loop guitar?
Absolutely. So, you know, this is a typical brand new off-the-shelf Lukather. Luke came out and played on my last solo record. He was the only other guitarist that I invited to play on my record.
Yeah.
And it was
good
really
choice.
It was really because when we first started getting ready to make that record, I had sat down and really made a good roadmap of who I would have play and do all this stuff. And anyway, he came in and played on this one song called Road to Forever. I love Luke. But I used this guitar because back at Hell Freezes Over, we had to do a couple of Henley's solo songs. Mm-hmm. And I think it's All She Wants to Do is Dance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Luke has a solo in that. And so before the first show that we did, which is in California, I said, I can't walk out in front of Steve Lukather, who's going to be sitting in the second row and play his solo without some sort of tribute to him. So I called Ernie Ball. I said, you got to send me a Luke guitar because I think it would be a nice tip of the hat to Luke to play his guitar on his solo.
Right.
So I went out and played it, and he came backstage and said, that's the coolest thing anybody has ever done. I said, well, I was just embarrassed to do it with, you know, a Fender or a Strat. I figured I'd give you the tip of the hat. You know,
that's
it's like
cool.
A sales pitch for, you know, the Luke guitars. And then so we've just become really great friends. And so I still carry one of these in my rig, and I use this on You Don't Have Me, which was one of the songs that was on my CD, Road to Forever. It's just a tip of the hat to Luke.
Awesome. What do you play on heavy metal?
My Les Paul.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Do you want to look at what I use? Pedals and amps and stuff?
Yeah, please, that'd be great. Okay, so this is a refreshingly modest pedal board.
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer in, you know, most of the tone comes out of your hand. It doesn't come out of a bunch of effects pedals. And if you have a good guitar and you're a good player, you can get by with very little extra bells and whistles.
Sure.
I've seen a lot of players that have these giant Bradshaw racks and these digital, I won't name brand, but digital kind of simulators.
Sure.
And that sort of stuff. And I just never think they sound like a real guitar. If you want to have that 90s fake guitar sound, that's really the rig you want to use. And all the records that I've made, I think the most elaborate setup I ever used on record was a 59 Les Paul, a 57 Tweed Deluxe, old Boss Chorus, I think it's a CH1, it's got like the knobs and the preamp on it, and an Echoplex.
Wow.
And that was heavy metal. So like, you know, that's as elaborate as it gets, is a little bit of echo and a little bit of chorus, and I don't really need much other than that. So to sound like I do on record, if I had a big Bradshaw rack or a bunch of other things, it just wouldn't make sense.
Right.
It's like the wrong. But plus, I like lean and mean.
Yeah.
This is really easy. It goes right into a case, rolls out into the truck, and boom, plug in one power strip and a guitar plug, and you're ready to go. So it's very simple. Basically, it's an OCD, made by Fulltone, and that's probably the best sounding, most realistic slight distortion pedal I've ever used.
Mm-hmm.
When you're playing live, you can't always turn the amp up as loud as you need to get that overdrive and sustain. So I can use just a little bit of that as almost like a preamp booster.
Right.
To not go overboard on distortion, but just to get that little extra edge and sustain you need. But this pedal works particularly well because when you turn down your volume on the guitar, the level of distortion doesn't go away, which is unusual. Like with other distortion pedals, when you turn down the volume of the guitar, the level of distortion diminishes too.
Yeah.
This level stays the same, but the volume just goes down.
Oh.
So whether your tone remains the same pretty much at whatever level, whether
you're
playing rhythm or you're playing lead, which is more natural.
Right.
I've always used Bosses as far as digital delays. You see, I have two of them. One is set for the time delay for Hotel California, the tempo for that, the BPM, beats per minute. And the other one that has that V on it is set for Victim of Love.
Oh, so there we go.
When I'm playing Victim of Love, I turn off one and I turn on the other.
Yeah.
It's that simple, and it's set to the proper slap for the tempo of Victim of Love, that 3-4, and then that's the... I use another little, you know, chorus by Boss. I really like their pedals. They're very simple, they're very clean. They're very easy to maintain. I mean, all you got to do is, if you keep a battery in them, just as backup, you don't need to do a lot of futzing.
Right.
Really easy to tune them in. And I've just been a big fan of those. They're lean and mean and simple, easy. I use a tuner over here, Peterson Tuners, which if during the show I need to just touch up something while I'm talking, I can turn that on with the pedal swung around before me, and I can just kind of tune by ear, and then I can turn that off and just check how close I am without doing something. I love these MXR talk boxes. I used to carry with the Eagles when we did Those Shoes Live. I used to carry a separate amp head and a regular talk box, which Joe and I made out of the old drivers for like theaters, movie theater speakers.
Really?
When you rip the cone out, and you got just the driver, and you had to fit the size of the hole that was coming out of the top. Sometimes it was taped on. It was just a pipe or a tube that came up. And to get the sustain, you needed to like turn that amp head up to where it was just, I mean, it would loosen the fillings in your mouth if you need to. This, you can really control the delay and the sustain and that sort of stuff, and the volume without deafening yourself. So I really like that little MXR talk box. It's fantastic. And power pedal, you know, the Voodoo Labs is just a really great, consistent power source. And that's about as complex as I get, you know?
And the only thing simpler is your amp, which is just right now a deluxe.
The standard deluxe reissue 65, Blackface 65. And when I go out and do extensive touring, when we go out and do 40 or 50 or 60 dates, I won't carry those. I have a couple of tweed deluxes that were the reissued deluxes that Alexander Dumble has completely modified. I think the only thing except that's not been changed is the Toilex on the outside, the tweed fabric on the outside, and the front panel. You know, Dumble's made me some really great stuff. He has one of my original old Blackface amps, 65 Blackface, that I mistakenly put in a Vox speaker in it and used it on the road with the Eagles. And on the front of it, it used to have this kind of Indian fabric that we put over instead of a grill cloth. So he's installing that back to its original condition. He's got access to like the right capacitors and resistors to get the original tone of that 65 back and the right speakers. You go in his bathroom, if you've ever been to his house, every square inch of his house is covered with parts. Right. I mean, he's got stacks of old speakers, and I mean, he does stuff for everybody. He rebuilds all Clapton stuff, just done my stuff. He just really takes certain clients under his wing, and I've known Alexander for a long time. I cannot tell you that there is a better sounding amp than an amp that he's worked on.
Wow. That's a good friend to have.
Yeah. It is indeed.
Yeah. Well, Don, it is such a honor to meet you, man. Thanks so much. And thanks for sharing this with all the people out there in interweb land.
Okay.
Hey, this is John Bolger. Till next time.
Don't forget to sign up for PG Perks, your all-access pass to exclusive gear giveaways and discounts on PremierGuitar.com.